From RTE Radio 1, you're listening to Arena Encore.
Michael Patrick King is one of the most influential voices in American TV comedy. As the executive producer, writer, and director behind Sex and the City, he helped define a cultural era. He went on to co-create Two Broke Girls, bringing his sharp timing to network sitcoms. But one of his most enduring creative partnerships is with Lisa Kudrow on The Comeback, the cult series that explores fame, reinvention, and the often crazy demands of the entertainment industry. It first aired in 2005, then returned in 2014. It's now back for a much-anticipated third season on HBO Max. I talked to Michael Patrick King earlier, but before that, here's a scene from The Comeback where Lisa Kudrow's Valerie Cherish is rehearsing with the Broadway cast of Chicago before she joins them.
Okay, stop. We have to stop.
Again, really?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes. You're not hitting the downbeat with your head. Your head bobs need to be much sharper.
Okay, got it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And your lips aren't matching. You're happy behind David.
Okay, who's David?
I am.
Okay, all right. Sorry, everyone, okay? I thought I'd have a chance to meet all of you and just say hello, I'm Valerie Cherish, you know, so we could bond, right? Yeah, but I get it, you've got a show tonight, so no time to be polite. I get it, yeah.
I'm delighted to be joined by the Emmy award-winning writer and director, Michael Patrick King. You're very welcome to Arena.
Thank you, I'm happy to be here.
Michael, maybe start by talking to us a little bit how you decided that now was the perfect time to bring back Valerie Cherish and The Comeback. Was that to do with real world shifts that you thought that might be interesting to talk about?
What became curious about The Comeback is our brand turned into we appear every 10 years. It wasn't supposed to be our brand. We got canceled after the first season and we thought the second season would come right after that. But what wound up happening is we sort of appear as there's a seismic shift in television. The first time we showed up, it was the threat of reality TV. The second time we showed up, it was the threat of dark premium cable streaming. And now here we are again, and it's the real threat of AI. And each of those threats created a sort of terror in the writing community of television and films. And whenever there's an enormous amount of fear, I think if you just lift that up a little bit, you can see the comedy under it. So when Lisa and I talked for many years about, like, would Valerie come back? Should we come back? It never really became a possibility until we thought Valerie being cast in the first sitcom written by AI is a big enough machine that we could really put a camera on where we all are in sort of that panic, but also make a very funny world for Valerie to try to navigate.
And that's something you deal with in the show. I presume as a writer of TV, that's something that you have strong feelings about yourself.
I do. I mean, anytime that a job is going to be taken away and potentially a learning, the classroom's going to go away. If AI takes over writing, there will be no journey for some young writer to figure out how to make a show based on some elder writer, not me, I'm not elder, some other writer who's older than me to tell them how to write. The threat of AI will take away the journey and, of course, the livelihood of a lot of young writers. And it takes away, you know, I'm not really worried about it taking away the spark because a machine can't have an individual spark. And that's all the television and film that we love comes from it. Outside idea that a machine could never think of. But it may make, as Lisa and I have both said, we thought reality TV was the end of narrative television. It wasn't. We just built another wing on the house, a tacky wing. But if you feel the mood to go into a tacky wing, you can go there. We're wondering whether that we'll just keep evolving television again to just incorporate this. Hopefully it won't be an extinction event, but just another mutation. There, that's the word I should use. Mutation for AI. It's a creative mutation.
What's it about?
I don't know.
Okay, what's the part?
I don't know.
Well, what do you know?
Well, I know that you're not going to have to deal with any asshole writers. It's being written by AI.
Uh-huh. Now, is that allowed?
Well, it must be because they're doing it.
Okay, yeah. Can I see a script? though.
Well, there's no script yet. They want to build it around the star.
Oh, wow.
What?
Yeah.
What's the problem, Val? You said yes to Mrs. Hatt without seeing anything.
Well, no, but because I knew what shows Mandy had written on and I liked them. So, yeah.
How interesting is it for you to pick up with somebody like Lisa and with a show like this many years later? Is that a complicated thing to have happen because it's been so long since you've worked together?
I think the most daunting thing about it is the fact that people think we did well before the other two are perceived as successful. So the great thing about being somebody, if you're creative, is once you start creating, you get almost a beta block about the anxiety and the risks, and you just sort of fall in. Lisa and I just in a writing room falling in love with what we're doing, falling through the process. When it's about to come out like it is now, that's where the daunting fear shows up. It's never a problem for me to be in a room with Lisa Kudrow. It's like a fountain. She opens her mouth as Valerie. I could do Valerie forever, but we can't necessarily find the right world for Valerie to really thrive in. It's not casual to us. It's very significant. But yeah, Valerie's funny going to Whole Foods to me, but it needs a bigger frame.
Maybe talk to me just a little bit about the very first series came out in 2005, when the concept of a mockumentary like this was still a relatively new idea in TV. It was something that wasn't as prevalent as you see now. So is the idea of the comeback something that essentially a lot of other television has now grown around to the point where nobody questions the idea of it?
I mean, the mockumentary was around. What wasn't around was the idea of a female character destroying themselves in front of the camera to create a brand. There was no Real Housewife yet. People didn't know why this woman who was beautiful and had money and had a husband would put herself in harm's way just to be in the spotlight. And that's the thing that people couldn't get. I mean, the UK office had already done the mockumentary here, but in America, people hadn't seen it yet. But it's the Valerie, the female protagonist who is putting themselves in harm's way, that made people thrown. And since then, you see what's happened. There's Real Housewives of everywhere and everything. And the thing that they penalized Valerie for and judged her for was her desperate need to control how she was coming across on camera with filters and lighting and dialogue. And now look, it's all anyone's doing. How do they control themselves on their Instagram? How do they control themselves in they're curating their life for people. So now everybody's Valerie. So people are like, oh yeah, that's not so bad. But when she appeared, it was really aberrant. People were like, I don't know what that is. And I think that's kind of why we went away. People didn't know what it was yet.
So I was hoping the girl who does your socials would be here. Are you going to take this?
Yes, sure. Yeah. Patience. Yeah, she is here. She's lying down in Mark's office. Poor thing, has a migraine.
Well, I have exciting Valerie news, and I thought that you might want her
to film it. Okay. So that's why you're really here. Okay. Yeah, I'll get her. Yeah, she's been down in about an hour or so.
I want to talk to you a little bit about writing strong female characters. And it's not just Valerie and it's not just Sex and the City. I mean, one of the earliest shows you wrote for was for Murphy Brown with the great Candace Bergen. So were you just really interested in writing strong female characters from the beginning, or did that experience set you down a path as a writer?
I have three sisters and my mother is really funny. And the first thing I ever wrote was a one-act play about my mother and my sister. I was always very interested in the dynamics of emotionally available characters in a world. So the first show I got was Murphy Brown, which is, of course, a show pony of a female character. She just ran, and it gave you permission to just write, and it just kept going. I think that what I love the most about the characters I've been able to work on or create is their individuality and their complete vibrancy. They're not just one thing, they're everything. They're funny, they're sad, they're tragic, they're verbal, they're emotional. you know, it's a really vibrant palette women allow you to do. I've also written all the men on Sex and the City, so that's a that's like a low-key thing I'm proud of. But the high density of female characters that I've been blessed to work on and these actresses that have gotten to play them is a real gift. It just feels like a natural desire of mine to write people like that.
In terms of Sex and the City itself, I mean, it broke so many taboos about sex and about single women in the late 90s.
I just wanted to let you know that my fireman was every bit the fantasy I had in mind.
New York's finest.
Fast cops.
Whatever.
I think it's wrong to sleep with a man just to fulfill a certain fantasy.
Please, all the men we sleep with fulfill a certain fantasy.
Or a nightmare.
You fantasize a man with a Park Avenue apartment and a nice big stock portfolio. For me, it's a fireman with a nice big hose.
And why are firemen always so fucking cute? Even when they're not that cute, they're still cute. What's up with that?
Well, first, there's a weight limit. And second, it's the hero thing. You know, you see him up on that truck.
That truck is hot.
Hurrying off to save someone trapped on a burning ledge or something.
Plus, they've got that I'm a good guy look in their eyes. It's that look.
Are you able now to look back at that and think about the cultural impact that it had?
I mean, I am so proud of the turning the word sex into pink, bubbly, Cosmo sex rather than dark, shameful, oil-dipped sex, which is what it was before the ladies started talking about it. Look, I'm Irish Catholic. I mean, the idea that I could exercise my demons about sex and my shame and make it funny is a great well for me of pride. And the fact that I could have women be funny and say outrageous things. And my belief system is the reason Sex and the City took off is because those characters were saying things that other women were thinking that hadn't yet said. So it just gave them permission. We didn't create that thought process. We were just the first people to put a camera on it with writers. People say Sex and the City, women aren't like that. I said, well, they would be if they had writers. That's what they would do. But yeah, no, I'm thrilled that the conversation changed. And I'm thrilled that people saw women that way. And I loved it. I think it had a reason to come into being. There's an anarchy to Sex and the City. I mean, society was telling 34-year-old women that they were already lepers, that they should have been married by now, and nobody wants them. So that voice of, I'm somebody without a partner or a man, needed to be amplified. And, you know, the fun connection between Valerie is Valerie, show business is telling her she's a leper, she should go away. So I'm always very curious when someone who's considered an outsider is trying to get inside.
As with Valerie in The Comeback, who you've written originally and then at various points throughout her life with large gaps in between, I mean, the same thing happened with Sex and the City and with And Just Like That. Is that something that interests you as a writer, being able to revisit characters much later on and see where their lives have taken them?
Yeah, I'm very interested in the evolution of a character. And especially if it's a character that people have connected to, that defined a certain point of their life, I am interested in how people change, what they leave behind, what they take with them. And to have a character that's already been painted vibrantly, to put new paint or change the frame, to write a character that changes, that the audience is aware of, is thrilling for me as a creator. What was surprising about And Just Like That is I realized a lot of people don't like their characters to change. They want them to stay exactly the way they liked them when they were 35. So now they're 59, and so are the people that liked them at 35. And it was a kind of a surprise that people like things the way they like them. Change is rough. It's rough in life when your friends change, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. And you as a friend have to sort of incorporate that. But I think the worst thing you can do creatively is to just stagnate and repeat. And so for better or worse, I am not interested in repeating. I like to move forward.
Just finally, I see from looking around various industry sites that you have a new series in development, The Back Nine with Renee Zellweger. Is that at a point where you can tell us anything about that?
Yeah, it's a movie, number one, and we've been trying to do it, and there have been a couple of bumps schedule-wise. I love it. It's about a woman who wanted to be a pro golfer at 22 but got scared and decides to try to accomplish her goals at 50. So it's a golf movie, and it's really about how you play the back nine of your life.
Michael Patrick King, it has been wonderful to talk to you tonight. Thanks for joining us on Arena.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye, Rick.
Cheers. Bye-bye. Last weekend, the legendary US comedy series Saturday Night Live arrived in the UK, 51 years after it made its debut in America. Famous for its celebrity hosts and political sketches, the show has launched the careers of everyone from Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi to Kristen Wiig, Will Ferrell and Tina Fey. But will the format work with a cast of mostly unknowns and for a non-American audience? Jen Gannon joins me now to look at the significance and history of Saturday Night Live and its new UK version. Jen, you're very welcome. Let's start at the beginning. Why does SNL hold this sacred place amongst comedians in the US?
I think it does because it's an incubator for generational comic talent. You just look back at these names that we know so well that have been through the Studio 8H doors. So you have the early days from Bill Murray, John Belushi, Gilda Radner, Eddie Murphy, Norm Macdonald, right down to Mike Myers, Will Ferrell, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Kristen Wiig and Maya Rudolph. And they're all people we might not know this side of the Atlantic. It might be a case of we never had that growing up. I remember when I was growing up, it was on Sky in the graveyard slot, so you'd rarely see it. Now with YouTube, TikTok, everything, you can catch up on clips, and it is broadcast on Sky as well, that there's more, you can dip into it more. But back in the day, you know, it was held with such reverence, I think, because you could see these people that we knew that went on to make most of our favourite American comedies, films. You could see them in their early days. You could see them when they'd just begun. There was an innate talent to, you know, the spotters, the people that actually picked these people out from audition. And can I say, that audition process is absolutely terrifying. If anybody watched the documentary, you have Lorne Michaels there, the creator, sitting in the shadows, and you have to perform in front of him and certain executive producers. There's no laughing. You barely get a laugh. So I don't even know how they make it through those auditions. But it's something, there's an innate talent there to spot these future stars. And it's had so many that have gone on, as I said, to be household names, that it is one to watch in certain ways. But in other ways, for us, I think you have, it's held with all this reverence, and you hear all these American comedians talking about it, that you think when you tune in, it's going to be, you know, sketch after sketch after sketch of pure gold. And it's kind of shonky. And a lot of it, like if you're on TV for 50 years and you're doing a live show week after week, there are going to be bad sketches. And you would tune in and think, why is Tom Hanks wearing this wig? And you know, why is he doing a stupid dance? That's a lot of the weeks, I have to say.
I remember the first time I got to watch it properly and seeing an entire set of those. The hit rate, certainly at the time I was watching it at that stage, wasn't great. But when it hit, no. You know, it hit.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. And when you have that gold, and it is a punishing schedule, just to say, it's not only about those ace faces that you see that are in front of the camera. There is a massive writing staff for SNL, and sometimes they transfer onto screen as well. So you'll have someone like Seth Meyers, you'd have John Mulaney, you'd also have Tina Fey, who spent 9 years as a writer before being thrust into the limelight on the screen. So they work super hard, and their schedule is ridiculous. And I do think that has something to do with the output as well and the quality of the output. I don't know why Lorne Michaels keeps them to this mad schedule where they're up all night on a Tuesday writing these sketches. You know, the Wednesday they go in to a table read. The Thursday is a dress rehearsal and editing the sketches and rewriting them. And Friday the same, and then it's go, go, go on Saturday. And they're writing
and
right up
actually
to the wire.
Live, live, live.
Exactly. And no wonder so many of them have substance abuse issues. How do you stay up all night? Like a whole Tuesday for like week after week writing and rewriting. And if you watch that behind the scenes documentary that came out last year, you'll see some of the writers crying, going, I have been writing one sketch for 7 hours and I don't think I'm getting it. So that kind of denotes how the output can work or not. And some of the sketches, the more surreal side of things, more Will Ferrell end of things, you know that somebody breaking at 4 o'clock in the morning just going, this was funny, we laughed at this in the writer's room, get it down on the page. And it has that air to it sometimes. And like, I guess it's like the Muppets, sometimes you want to see the show come together in a ramshackle way, and that may be the charm of it too.
I'm going to play some clips, both from the new SNL UK as well, but from classic Saturday Night Live as well. This is, do you want to set this one up first? This is the Eddie Murphy White Like Me sketch.
Yeah, I think like Eddie Murphy was a breath of fresh air to Saturday Night Live when he came in the early 80s. And he struck them as a Richard Pryor type firebrand figure. And this was, I mean, he wrote so much great material for them at the time, but this is a spoof mockumentary, White Like Me, from 1984, about spending the day as a white man in America. So think the precursor to White Chicks. He's made up as a white man going around doing various things like going to a newsagent's and going on the bus, like fairly regular things. But there's this rawness and ridiculous to it, the lampoon and white privilege that I think the show sorely needed at that time.
And this is a moment from it. So this is Eddie Murphy in whiteface experiencing the benefits of white privilege when the black loan officer that he's being served by is suddenly replaced by a friendly white bank manager.
Harry, why don't you take your break now? I'll take care of Mr. White.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Bob.
That was a close but one.
It certainly was.
We don't have to bother with these formalities, do we, Mr. White, huh?
What a silly Negro.
Just take what you want, Mr. White. Pay us back any time. Or don't. We don't care.
And Mr. White gets everything he's looking for. Why do you think it's taken so long for it to transfer across the Atlantic? I mean, there's been suggestions of it a number of times. It's just never come off.
For a long, long time. And I think, you know, there is obviously a wealth of talent, comedic talent in the UK and in Ireland, obviously. And I think that is something that Lorne Michaels always wanted to do, but it never quite made it. And I guess it's because there is a tradition of sketch show comedy in the UK, but it's petered out a bit. Like, you had pre-recorded shows like The Fast Show or Big Train, which was kind of cult, but people loved it. And then you had, you know, and I think that kind of moved, it went out of style a bit. Like, when I was growing up, I used to watch Whose Line Is It Anyway on Channel 4 and watch Paul Merton and you know.
One of my favourite shows on TV.
It was great. Like, but I think it moved on to, you see the shiny floor panel, those panel shows where you'd have comedians on Mock the Week or 8 out of 10 Cats, and that's getting them in front of a new audience. That's getting the new comedians out there to test out their stuff in a safe environment that doesn't have the squeaky bum kind of cringe nerves of sketch comedy. So I think something that is probably its closest comparison would be something like Taskmaster, which is absolutely unstoppable. And the reason why I think it hooks an audience in so much as well is because you get to know this troupe of certain comedians over a number of weeks. And that's what Saturday Night Live does. So maybe they felt now was the right time, with the success of something like Taskmaster, that this could go through and people would be more willing to open up to see a troupe of relatively unknowns for weeks at a time.
Part of what they must be weighing up here as well, though, is you're right, those kind of shiny floor panel shows, they're incredibly cheap to make and you can make an awful lot of them. Something like this with a big writing staff and where you have filmed elements, it costs a lot more money.
It does, and you've got the celebs as well. Let's not forget the bands that are of the moment, acts that you have to have on, and making a lot of props. Like in the US one, so much time and dedication goes into making the props where you want a severed head. Here's 10 that we've made earlier. Here's one that Bill Murray used in 1976. Who doesn't want to have that? But also, because sketches are ditched at the last moment, Lorne can come in on a Friday and say, that's out, that's out, we hate this now, that the props that they've made can go to waste. So it is big money and it is a risk. And I think when people are complaining, going, why is this on Sky? Why is this not on Channel 4? Maybe Channel 4 did not want to take the risk money-wise to put this out there where Sky has the money behind them. Whether they have the dedicated and big viewership that they're banking on, it remains to be seen, I suppose.
One of the major pluses I've seen being talked about regarding the new UK version is that the cast are all young and they're all fairly unknown, and there aren't a lot of places for that sort of talent to turn up en masse on UK TV these days.
Yeah, which I like. I mean, you're going to find these people on social media maybe, or, you know, not having a big part in a lot of TV shows, TV comedy shows. So I think that's something as well, and that's something to be commended. And of course they should be 25. You know, this is the new guard. You want fresh new talent. And as you said, there isn't a lot of shows that are doing that, that are pushing people to the forefront like this. So you do have people like Anya Magliano. People might know her. She was actually on the 20th season of Taskmaster. And the viral impressionist Al Nash. You have stage and TV actor Hamid, I think it's Animation. And there's a load of them. There's a whole host of them. And but also in the writing room, we have, you know, the very funny Irish writer Gráinne Maguire and Nathan Fode. I think people know him from TikTok as well. So you've got so many people there that are ready, chomping at the bit to have their moment. And I think that's really commendable for one.
Okay, I want to take something from the current UK version. This is quite brief, but it's from their Weekend Update, which is their news segment that occurs in the middle of the episode. This is one of the anchors, the aforementioned Anya Magliano.
Renovations to Andrew Mountbatten Windsor's new home, Marsh Farm, have been taking place over the last month, including the installation of Sky TV. So, if you're watching, Andrew, hello! You're not going to like this next bit. Also, I'm older than I look.
Going out live for a bunch of young performers like that, that must be impossibly intimidating. Like, what did you see when you were watching the episode, opening night jitters?
There was a few shakes, and I felt for George Fouracres, because there was a sketch that it was touching on Brat Summer, but through a spoof of Hamnet, where he was playing a kind of Paul Mescal playing Shakespeare, but doing it as Paul Mescal with his little mullet and his tiny chain and earring and his shorts coming in on his e-scooter. And it was funny, but he did flub a few lines and I did feel for him. But also I felt for the Weekend Update guys, because Tina Fey was the queen of Weekend Update. She's there hosting the show, watching you. So no wonder. Now, they were both great, like did it very well. But you could see that there was this tenseness there. And that's why I think starting off, I think the cold opens for me never work. They never work for us like proper SNL, US SNL. I think they're pretty shocking because they go on for too long and they're just not funny. And it was the same here with the Keir Starmer sketch ringing Trump that fell very flat for me. So I think if they even started off with a pre-recorded sketch, because their first pre-recorded sketch was very, very funny. It was about like a face cream that made women look so young. They looked terrifyingly young and their partners were getting into trouble with various people. And it was actually very funny. So, I mean, something like that would maybe have steadied the ship a bit more and then gone into the live sketches.
If you really like sketch TV comedy, in particular topical sketch TV comedy, there's not a lot of that on UK TV or Irish TV anymore, is there? I mean, it is filling a gap.
It is filling a gap. And I think, you know, we had Your Bad Self, and I think a lot of people talk about
mentioned
Your
on
Bad
the show
Self
more than once in the last
yeah,
few months.
I mean, yeah. And then we had, you know, No Worries If Not, but they're all pre-recorded. And there's something about that live element that you know, they're not all stand-up. So some of them are actors, and you want that mix and you want that exuberance to it, but also that little bit of a fear factor. You want to see where this is going, and will somebody swear? I mean, famously on US SNL, Jenny Slate swore her first time and she was axed, got rid of straight away. So you're kind of wondering, will that anarchy hold for the UK? Will they allow them to have a few swears? You know, it's weird because they are beholden to the networks. Like Saturday Night Live has this ideal for being reckless and loose, but they're very beholden to NBC. So they have to play the game. And I wonder, will this be the same for Sky as well?
Do you think Tina Fey worked as the first guest host? It's bringing in that element of US SNL, and she is royalty from that show. But there was also an element of, well, she could, in theory, intimidate, you know,
I would have been terrified. Like, I, as someone who loves her, I would have been terrified to know that she was out there judging me, because she does judge. Like, she has said before about US SNL that she doesn't think that the writer's room is as vicious as it used to be. And she said, when you put in a sketch and leave the room, they should all be tearing it apart. They should be tearing you apart. It's not comfortable. These are not your best friends. You're there to work. So she has a very keen, you know, tense work ethic to her. So I would have been intimidated. But she is also a really safe pair of hands to have this show, to have that first moment. She had a great moment in the opening monologue with Graham Norton, where she went through a load of British sitcom references. Loved that. Loved her little, you have to watch it because there's so many. She's doing Mrs. Slocum from Are You Being Served?
She was.
Bits of The Office. Yeah. It was well worth it. So I think having someone who is so self-assured about the realm of Saturday Night Live was a big bonus.
These days, I mean, a chunk of the success of a show like this depends on whether or not you have clips that will then ultimately work on social media. Did you see either it being written to play towards any of that, or did that make any sense?
You need a second life. You need a second life online. This will die, live and die by that. And I do think something like Weekend Update, they need to be sharper. They needed the jokes to go further. Even with that Prince Andrew joke, I was like, push it more, because it's a UK and Irish audience that have grown up on Brass Eye. They've grown up on the day-to-day. You want it to be toeing that line and being very edgy. And that's what makes, you know, comedy gasp-worthy. And people on TikTok going, I can't believe this happened. So that's, they need that edge more, I think. But somebody like George Fouracres, I can see him. He was one of my standouts because he had this song at the very end.
I'm not sure what was going on in that song in the final
sketch.
It was
brilliant. Yeah. What kind of Irish was your granddad? Is your granddad? And, you know, on paper, that sounds utterly miserable, a terrible idea. But actually, it's the closest to the sweaty, surreal strangeness of Reeves and Mortimer that I wanted from that show. And I loved it. And I think when the show leans into those, you know, idiosyncrasies of UK-ness, it works better.
OK, I want to finish it with this from classic SNL. This is the iconic sketch written by and starring Will Ferrell as Blue Oyster Cult's cowbell player and Christopher Walken as the music producer, the Bruce Dickinson.
That it doesn't work for me. I gotta have more cowbell.
Don't blow this for us, Gene!
Could be so selfish, Gene.
Can I just say one thing?
Yeah, baby, just say it.
I'm standing here staring at rock legend Bruce Dickinson.
The cock and a walk, baby.
And if Bruce Dickinson wants more cowbell, we should probably give him more cowbell.
Say, baby.
And Bobby, you are right. I am being selfish. But the last time I checked, we don't have a whole lot of songs that feature the cowbell.
I gotta have more cowbell, baby.
But I'd be doing myself a disservice and every member of this band if I didn't perform the hell out of this.
Guess what? I got a fever. And the only prescription is more cowbell.
Still one of the funniest things ever on television after all these decades. Saturday Night Live UK continues on Sky One at 10 p.m. and you can watch the first episode on Now TV and Sky. Before we go, Jen, the nominees for this year's BAFTA Television Awards were announced today. Amongst the Irish stars nominated, Graham Norton and Philippa Dunn. Philippa Dunn nominated in the Actress in a Comedy category for Amandaland. Graham Norton nominated in Entertainment for the Graham Norton Show. Trespasses, the Channel 4 drama adapted from Louise Kennedy's novel, is nominated in the Limited Drama Field, written by Irish writer Alva Keoghan and produced by Donegal's Maria Mulhall. Director Seamus Malone nominated for Shaun the Sheep in the Children's Scripted category. Dublin director Dermot Goggins in the drama series for Code of Silence. And in the BAFTA Craft Awards today as well, Irish editor Una Ní Gonaille has been nominated for her work on Prisoner 951. The ceremony is hosted by Greg Davies on Sunday, May 10th, and it'll be broadcast on BBC One. But there's a missing part here, you think?
Yeah, I mean, I loved Trespasses. I think it was like one of my favourite shows of last year for sure. It was just stunning, and I don't know if enough people were watching it or what happened, but it is thankfully nominated for a lot of the writing and directing, which it definitely should be. But also, where's Lola Pettigrew? Like, I mean, I think she's gave such a beautifully measured, nuanced performance as Kushla, the star of the piece, and I think they're missing out, and I think they will regret this. This is a Jesse Buckley size regret that we're going to have in the coming years.
Jen Gannon, thanks for joining us tonight.
You're listening to Arena Encore. You can listen to Arena every weeknight from 7 on RTE Radio 1 and the RTE Radio Player app.
Born Eric Arthur Blair in 1903 in India, George Orwell served as a colonial police officer in Burma. It was a transformative experience that left him with a profound lifelong hatred of imperialism. He later fought against fascism in the Spanish Civil War, ultimately dedicating his literary career to democratic socialism and the fight against totalitarianism. What he's best known for are his landmark allegorical novel, Animal Farm, and his terrifyingly prophetic swan song, 1984, written while he was dying of tuberculosis on the Scottish island of Jura. His vast body of essays remains just as vital today. This Friday sees the release in cinemas of a new documentary that argues that Orwell is more relevant now than ever. directed by Oscar-nominated filmmaker Raoul Peck, Orwell 2 plus 2 equals 5 uses the author's own words, voiced by the actor Damian Lewis, to explore his life and career. But the film isn't just a biography, it's a stark visual essay. Peck weaves Orwell's 20th century warnings with 21st century footage, drawing a direct, unflinching line from the totalitarian regimes of the past to our modern political landscape of alternative facts, doublespeak and rising authoritarianism. Paul Whittington joins me now in studio to talk about the new documentary and Orwell's enduring relevance. Paul, before we talk about Orwell, remind us about the director Raoul Peck and about his previous work and his own background, which obviously informs his interest in Orwell.
Absolutely. I mean, he was born in Haiti, and he was evacuated with his family as a child to escape the Papa Doc Duvalier dictatorship, and so he actually grew up in Africa and then in American France, and he's a very interesting documentary maker because he has a very distinctive style, as you mentioned just before we came on, and people may have seen his documentary about James Baldwin, I'm Not Your Negro, which was a very powerful piece of work, and he also made a very good documentary about Patrice Lumumba, the Congolese visionary who was assassinated in the early 60s. So he's very interested in politics, so his interest in Orwell makes a lot of sense. And he situates in time, as you mentioned, he situates it in 1946 after the war. And Orwell already has TB. He's had lung problems for a while, and he smoked like a chimney as well, which probably didn't help. And he decided he felt a new novel coming, and it was they were actually going to call it The Last Man in Europe, and then somebody else said, how about 1984?
I still prefer The Last Man in Europe as a title. Yeah, the only one.
It's quite good. Somebody should write a book with the title The Last Man in Europe. And he went, as you say, to Jura in the Hebrides, and he started writing. So in the documentary, we come and go from some of his thinking and some of his the very seminal quotes about totalitarianism, which come from his essays, which are amazing. And Damian Lewis reads them, and he reads them very well, because Orwell was shot through the throat in the Spanish Civil War, and so he spoke very softly afterwards. Sadly, none of his BBC, he used to do stuff like this in the BBC, but sadly none of it survives. So he's up there, he's writing, and then we're coming and going. And the big thing the documentary is trying to do is to make connections between Orwell's ideas and the present, and that's very easy to do.
Okay, I want to get to those, but for me, some of the most interesting parts of the documentary are where Orwell himself talks about his own childhood and his own upbringing.
Yes.
So maybe for those people who aren't familiar with that part of his life story, maybe give us a little potted history of that.
Yeah, we could actually have done almost with even more of that than we got. I agree entirely. Yeah, as you mentioned at the start, he's born in 1903 in India. And he's a member of, as you said, he called it the lower upper middle class, by which he meant these families with notions, basically, who thought they really ought to have servants and be posh and everything, but they had the arse out of their trousers. A lot of them ended up in India because you could live higher on the hog in India than you could in, you know, Surbiton or somewhere. So over there, they could have servants, they could live the high life and pretend to be English gentlemen or whatever. And so
he's very specific about it. Those people who knew how to shoot but didn't have an inch of ground to shoot over, I think, is what he refers
which is,
to.
Which
as.
Is a brilliant description. And that is what he was born into. And he came back, I think he was something like four when they came back to England. And I think he had a sense of that as he grew up. And he's quite funny. People tend to think of him as humorless, but I'm not sure I agree. In his essays, he does have a sense of humor. And he says that he was a lonely, withdrawn child, and he tended to have imaginary friends, and that he developed, what did you call them, irritating mannerisms, which made it difficult for him to socialize at school. He went to St. Cyprian's, which actually Cyril Connolly went to as well, if people remember that, the great critic and writer from the mid-20th century. He went to the same sort of, you know, preparatory school, and then he went to Eton, and he hated it all. He wrote an essay called Such Were the Joys about how miserable his childhood had been. But he knew he wanted to write from a very early age, and he was good at that. But when he left school, everybody thought he might go on to Cambridge or Oxford, and he probably would have got the points at the time, but he didn't. He went to India. He joined the Burma. He joined the Imperial Police, and he went there, and that totally changed his life.
it is very safe to say that that is the defining period of time in his life, without whom he wouldn't have become the writer he then later became.
Absolutely, because in many ways he was a product of his time. I mean, you know, he was not especially evolved when it came to women, and even though he was aware of it, he was had the same snobbish impulses as any sort of lower upper middle class person would have had. But the difference with him was that he fought against them. In Burma, he saw the sort of just ingrained racism of the British colonial type. And he became an instrument of oppression himself. He says he did. Like, he would get annoyed by people, and he could feel himself despising local people because they were poor or whatever. They didn't speak English properly. And then he saw a hanging, which he wrote a brilliant essay about, and he understood suddenly what it meant to kill, you know, a conscious, healthy man. And he talked about how, because at that point it was perfectly common for people to be in favour of capital punishment. It turned him against that, it turned him against the empire, it turned him towards socialism, and it also ingrained into him this real dislike of authoritarianism and subsequently totalitarianism.
1984 is key in the film. It's the thing that runs all the way through it in terms of attempting to show where totalitarianism was in the late 1940s, what Orwell saw of it, and essentially how many of his words can be overlaid over things that have happened in the 21st century and very recently. But for him, where was he in his life? I know he was ill. We've spoken about that. Mm. But he was at a point in his life where he had already had some success. He had worked for the BBC and he had had success as a writer.
He had.
And at this stage, though, he's not well, and then takes himself off to the Scottish island of Jura to write what he thinks is his next big thing.
Yeah, and he may even have... Actually, I don't think he suspected it was his last, because he was quite the optimist in terms of his health. He had plans, and also he had become a father himself, and his sainted first wife Eileen had adopted a child, Richard, who is still alive. He was interviewed by The Guardian quite recently. He's a very jolly, kind of suburb, lower upper middle class perhaps man, and he that was one thing that Orwell took seriously. He took fatherhood seriously, and he took him to Jura a lot, and Richard has great memories of that. But he was thinking again. He had his previous book, which is the other one he's famous for, Animal Farm, which has been on, you know, school curriculums for a long time. He had deliberately set out to try and... he was a great admirer of Dean Swift, and he wanted to fuse, you know, this kind of fabulous satire with politics, with political ideas. And that was a satire of Stalinist excesses. And this book is often misunderstood as this kind of, far-sighted dystopian prediction, but it wasn't. It was 1984 was 1948 backwards. It was again. He was very irritated by the London left-wing intelligentsia who were very sentimental about the USSR and would remain so for many decades. He was much clearer about that, thanks to his experiences in the Civil War, and he wanted to have a pop at Stalin again and to prove really that there was no difference effectively between Stalinism and fascism.
Okay, I want to take a clip from one of the versions, and I think there are clips from almost every filmed version of 1984 that exist in this, and there are multiple.
There's about five or six of them, isn't there?
Yeah, this is from the 1956 version. This is the interrogation scene between O'Brien and Winston. You have Edmund O'Brien, who's playing Winston, and Michael Redgrave, who's playing O'Brien.
How many fingers am I holding up, Winston?
Four.
And if Big Brother were to say not four, but five, then how many?
Four.
Oh. How many fingers, Winston?
Stop it. Anything you're five. But
no, Winston. Winston, that is no use. You are lying. You still think you see four.
How can I help when it's five?
Two and two do not always make four, Winston. Sometimes they make five. Again, how many fingers am I holding up?
The film leans very heavily into the connection of Big Brother, the visuals, the party, the hate, the slogan "War is peace" with modern political movements and modern political figures. How well does that work for you?
Well, a little too well, maybe, because like I feel towards the end, I'm feeling like I have your point, but it is at the same time like it has never not been relevant as a book of ideas, you know, and all the. you know, I mean, Orwellian became a term as a consequence of 1984, and thought crime, all this stuff, and doublespeak. There are lots of despots around the world who are guilty of doublespeak at the moment. And obviously, when you think of that moment where O'Brien, you know, is holding up his fingers, he's holding up four and saying, how many fingers am I holding? But he's wanting him to say five. And of course, eventually he does crack and say five. You know, you think about Donald Trump looking for the Nobel Peace Prize or something like that. This is it. The first victim of totalitarianism is truth and you know, objective reality. And he's very strong on that. In fact, in a series of essays, he actually broke down and analysed how totalitarianism works. And that's very useful, you know, as a kind of device. But yeah, no, it draws. Not just with the present the film does, but with, you know, the 1930s, which is obvious, the 1940s, time and again, when any semblance of democracy collapses and what happens subsequent to that.
He walked the walk as well, though. He wasn't Absolutely. Just somebody who talked the talk. Yeah. I mean, in Down and Out in Paris and London, he lived as a transient man and then lived as a dishwasher in Paris. He went to Spain to fight against fascism. What do we learn of his time in Spain during the Civil War? I mean, his wife Eileen was there with him as well at the time.
She was, and in fact, she's somewhat occluded, and there's been some kind of work on that recently. There's a book, I think, and she was a writer as well, and she was apparently a very sort of witty, clever person. They both went very high-minded. They both went to Spain, and they ended up fighting with this with PUM, which was a kind of left-wing but not communist group around Barcelona. And he saw action, and he got shot. And he always said he got shot because he was about 6'2" or something, and all the Spanish people were 5'7". So he was an easy target. So he got shot in the neck because of that. But that is where he learned to detest Soviet communism, because it was Moscow-backed communists who went after all his comrades subsequently and jailed them and killed some of them and so forth. So that's where he fundamentally understood how the Soviet Union fundamentally worked. But as you say, so engaged. I mean, that's why he changed his name, because when he did the Down and Out in Paris and London, he didn't want to embarrass his family. That's why he chose the name George Orwell.
What do we learn of his relationship with his wife? It's a really interesting one, and there's a lot of change that there has been about the nature of the perception of his relationship to his wife in the last couple of years. Do we learn enough about her and about the tragedy of her life? There's a sense these days that, you know, his treatment of women wasn't exactly stellar.
It wasn't terrific, but again, he was somewhat of his time, and also he was quite honest about it, to be honest with you. I really think that he did not consider her career in the way he considered his own as seriously, and I think that he did have a number of affairs, and he actually did not consider himself good looking, and he was correct in that assessment. But that didn't stop him. So he had a number of affairs, and she did know about them. But I suppose the corollary of that is that he was devastated when she died. So whatever their relationship was, there seemed to be depth to it. And the other person who isn't really mentioned in the film is Sonia, his second wife, who became a controversial figure with some of his friends because she married him when he was in the TB ward, basically. So there was a view about that. But however, she was a fierce custodian of his legacy, and it was her that stopped David Bowie doing his 1984 musical, which is a pity, really, because he wrote all those songs for it. And maybe he doesn't have a wonderful reputation in that regard, but he did take parenthood seriously.
You think, as many people do, that his essays are his greatest contribution. Talk to me maybe just a little bit about those.
Well, I think they are. I think he was probably one of the two or three greatest essayists of the 20th century. Now, it is a form that has sort of fallen out of use, and since Gore Vidal's gone, there's even less people doing it. But he was brilliant. A lot of his essays came from a column that he had with the Tribune, a left-wing... that Michael Foote, the politician, was an editor of it for a while. And they offer he's brilliant on politics. His book reviews are exceptional and quite frightening, to think that your book could ever be approached by an eye like his. But he would also talk about social things, about the price of cigarettes and how people live. He was fascinated by how the working class live, almost in a sort of, you know, anthropological sense, really, because he really, however close he felt he was to them, he sort of didn't understand them. He wanted to be accepted by them. But his essays, there's a huge collection of them, and I would, you know, advise anybody to read them, because it's not just full of ideas, but it's kind of a microcosm of Britain in his time.
And still in print even to this day.
Absolutely.
I'm going to leave the last word to Dermot, who's texted us, and he said, Rick, the Blades once had a great song called The Last Man in Europe, which is new information
they
for me.
They did, so no one means to write the book then.
And
okay.
Then, therefore, that's going to go into the use for me in a table quiz at some point. Paul Whittington, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks,
George
Rick.
Orwell's 2+2=5 is released in Irish cinemas this Friday, and it'll be reviewed on Arena.
You're listening to Arena.
That's it for this week's Arena Encore. You can listen to Arena live on RTE Radio 1 every weekday evening from 7. And you can listen back via the RTE Radio Player, rte.ie, or wherever you get your podcasts.